Happy New Year, everybody! Happy 2021!
We made it! The trauma is over. Everything's fine now.
Yes, everything's great. Everything's perfect now. The world is not on fire anymore. Huzzah! Go outside. Look at the sun, everyone.
Yes. Well, actually, Nelson, it's kind of like we find ourselves at a crossroads, if you will. Like, will things turn out great or will they turn out terrible? It's almost like two paths we could take.
Yes. You know, there's sort of a metaphor that we've got ready-made for this episode. See, we are going to watch the movie Crash tonight.
It's crash time.
You're saying to yourself, okay, which one are you talking about? And the truth is, we don't know yet.
Most of you are probably saying, there's more than one Crash? What are you talking about?
Olangino has got a coin. I have written down what the coin toss will mean. He's going to flip it. He's going to announce the results.
Yes, two roads diverge in a yellow wood, and sorry, I could not have a car crash at both. We got
All right.
All right, here we go. Let's find out which crash universe.
How is 2021 going to go? Is it going to be about crashing cars to have a weird sexual experience, or is it about crashing cars because, you know, everybody in Los Angeles is racist? Which is it going to be? You know, is it about weird sex or white-splaining? Let's find out.
All right, the moment is upon us. I am flipping the coin. The coin has landed on heads.
Oh my. This could have gone better. I remember the night I saw this movie very distinctly. My wife and I went to dinner. I believe it was for our anniversary. Might have even been our first anniversary. Anyway, we had some good-ass Italian food on Ventura Boulevard and decided to hit the movie show. We went to see a movie that had been getting some real good word of mouth and had a shitload of stars in it. We watched it, I enjoyed it, and I promptly forgot about it. Until Oscar season rolled around. Then no one would shut the fuck up about it. I was seeing it on billboards, in the trades, I was getting free copies of it sent to me left and right, but I never watched it again. Ever. Even after it won every fucking award on the planet. It was so weird. I liked it. I did. But I liked it way more before people decided this shit was an Oscar-worthy masterpiece. My wife won't even call it by its name. She calls it Fisher-Price, My First Movie About Racism. And you know what? There's probably something to that. So maybe it's time to give another watch to Crash.
Welcome to The Hold Up. Each month, we pick a movie one of us remembers fondly but hasn't seen in years. We watch it and we decide, does it hold up? I'm John Longino.
And I'm John Nelson.
And just like all things could go wrong in 2020, apparently 2021 will follow in suit. Our beloved Cronenberg film might have to wait for another day, Mr. Nelson. We are watching Paul Haggis's Best Picture, Crash.
Okay.
But before we get to our movie, we should get to our emails.
Yay!
Because, Mr. Nelson, we received an email. Anyone who would like to can always email us at holduppodcast@gmail.com, where we are running a prize to our sixth individual unique email. So the sixth person, not the sixth email we receive, but the sixth person to email us will receive a mystery prize.
So sorry to our first emailer. You didn't win, but you do get the honor, quote unquote, of having us read your email on our show. So there's that.
So we have our first not winner, one of five.
Let's say, you know, along with Crash 2004 and 2020 being what it is, I'm sure this is just in keeping for him. So
yes, let me ring in the new year with disappointment for Tyler.
Yay!
Our friend Tyler, whom we received our first email from for the non-prize that he won
for the new year. Tyler, you're the first one in the door.
He wrote us. Tyler writes, "Hey, Johns. Just wanted to say happy holidays and hope you have a healthy one. Love your last holiday podcast and found the discussion interesting about whodunit films. I think that I agree the format is very typical, but honestly, I love it. The films are definitely better when they have interesting characters, With that said, what are your thoughts on Alfred Hitchcock?
Ooh.
His films definitely have a format, and he even struggled with the thought of himself as an artist. So curious to know what your thoughts are. Best wishes, Tyler. P.S. I hope to be the sixth email. I have a feeling I'm the third, but most likely I'm the second email.
Oh, Tyler, overestimating us yet again.
You are the first email in reality, so
welcome. Well, congratulations. You won the first through the door prize, which is nothing.
Oh, yes, which is nothing. But in terms of his question, Alfred Hitchcock, Nelson, what are your thoughts?
I don't know if I'm going to, shock anybody, but I have enjoyed all of Alfred Hitchcock's films. There's not a goddamn thing wrong with anything he does. I just sort of assume his movies are great. I don't like watch them and, masturbate to them, I guess.
Well, first of all, how dare you, sir? That's
all. Well, I knew I wasn't going
to. I masturbate to every one of them, and it feels fantastic.
Well, I mean, I hope so.
I'm definitely in the more traditional nerdy film camp of Alfred Hitchcock is a master of cinema. I adore his movies. I adore Hitchcock. I mean, the man made some of the best movies ever.
I mean, he made Psycho, which alone is one of the best movies I've ever seen. So,
Psycho is easily
one of
my favorite films ever. Psycho, Rear Window, Vertigo, North by Northwest, one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. Like, certainly there's a niche, but he can do like horror, he can do comedy, he can, he has a range. I am a lover of Hitchcock, so that's where I land.
When I think of my favorite movies or directors, usually Hitchcock is not even, it doesn't rattle through my brain.
Well, it's a rattling in mine. So there you go. I mean, that sounds about right. Some people he's revered. Some people it's like, it's kind of like a Beatles thing.
Right.
Like, there's the camp of like, well, the Beatles are masters of music. And then there's the camp that like, I mean, they're fine, but they're kind of overrated. The first camp, the master camp, is the correct one, by the way, just so everybody knows.
Sure.
Stay tuned for my Beatles podcast in 2021.
One of the only Beatles podcasts you will ever hear.
Well, alas, Mr. Nelson, we have arrived at our movie, which, as we found out with a toss of heads, is Paul Haggis's Crash. So, what is Paul Haggis's Crash about?
It's about racism. That's what it's about. It's about how everybody in L.A. is racist somehow. And much like Lost.
I mean, that's not untrue, honestly.
It's all connected. Everybody in L.A. is connected by their racism. I mean,
is the smoke monster in this?
Yeah. Well, it would have made it probably a different film for sure. I'm not going to say better because I know Crash has gotten a lot of hate, and I'm giving it sort of, the shade right now. But the thing is, I watched it, and I was like, okay, sure. I enjoyed it.
Sure.
But there was something about, and this could be me, so I do have a real, get-your-hackles-up reaction to, fanboys and, being told, the Hitchcock thing. Being told something is awesome, well, sometimes I drink the Kool-Aid, and other times, even if it's true, even if it's like, yes, Hitchcock is the greatest guy ever, then I'll just be like, there'll be something in me that's like, oh, yeah? How dare you? You're not telling me what to like. You're not telling me what's good. And I don't know if this movie counts as that, but I definitely felt like I had that reaction. Whenever people start saying, oh, my God, Crash, that movie's amazing. Oh, how good it is. And I'm like, well, I mean, it was fine, but it ain't like, I don't think it needs no Oscar. And then it won all of them.
Certainly.
So did it only win the one? I'm saying it won all these Oscars, but it didn't win.
Well,
like,
it won Best Picture, which is certainly the grand prize of the whole thing,
right? But I mean,
and probably the most remembered award.
It's that idea that the everybody's third favorite film wins Best Picture,
right?
The way the voting goes.
This is not a new concept at all. If you look at the history of the Oscars, it's always the third best movie that wins. Whatever. There are exceptions. There's years where look at No Country for Old Men won. Great, we can all agree that's phenomenal. Moving on, but I would say most years, the forgettable movie wins.
This is
kind of crowd pleasing movie.
Yeah, because most years it's like you'll get something, but it just seems like in the last decade, especially since they've started adding movies. Like the amount of movies to the best picture, because it used to be five. You had a top limit of five movies you were voting on. Now it's 10. So there could be up to 10 movies you're voting on. And I feel like the pool just gets that much more diluted. It's like, it's not that there can't be 10 awesome movies. It's just very rarely does the Academy manage to find the 10 that I think were the top. And I'm sure I'm not the only person who thinks that, because when something like Green Book wins Best Picture of the Year or whatever right. it was, sure. and people just sort of go, wait, which one now? I don't even remember that movie. If there's, this is one of those like star-studded, it's a mad world, except it's not funny.
It's a racist
it's a racist world.
Yes, because racism is the theme of Crash, but what do you remember specifically about like the story? Like, what is Crash actually about?
I don't think it's just one story. I think it's just that there's a crash at the beginning that sort of ripples out to the rest of LA and other characters get involved, but it stems from like there's an incident in the beginning, then that ripples out to this person here, which ripples out to this person here, which ripples out to this other person. As everything ripples out, you see people's reaction to race and anger and, you know, how they abuse their fellow man, and it finally comes back around, and you know, somebody who had a bad experience with somebody in the beginning suddenly has a good experience, and vice versa. The heroes become the villains become the heroes. Everybody lives in a world of gray. And it has just a lot of stars in it. That's what was memorable. It's got, you know,
yes,
Ludacris. It's got War Machine. What's his name?
Don Cheadle, right?
Is he in that too? God, he's everybody.
I believe Don Cheadle's in it.
Matt Dillon. You said War Machine. God, who else? Sandra Bullock? Is she in it? Is it like a real brief person?
I don't know.
There's a famous
I very much remember Matt Dillon.
Yes.
Matt Dillon, he's like one of the more memorable characters. He's like a corrupt cop or like just a racist shitty cop that sees the light of day or something. I kind of remember something about that.
And then there's Terrence, I keep wanting to say Terrence Stamp, but that's not Terrence War Machine, the guy who Don Cheadle
Terrence
replaced.
Howard.
Yes. There you
Wait,
go.
So we got both War Machines up.
We got
here.
Both War Machines, I think. Well, Terrence is, I remember him as very specifically. This is about when I started noticing him, because he did this and he did,
Hustle and Flow.
Hustle and Flow. You know, the one, yeah. Speaking of Razor. Oscars, where 3-6 Mafia got their Oscar before Scorsese.
That was so great. Yeah, John Stewart was like, 3-6 Mafia, one Oscar. Martin Scorsese, zero Oscars.
Yeah, at the time hilarious. He didn't have. Now they both tied. They both have one apiece. But yeah, he's in it, and he has a great experience, because he's got that thing that I, as a completely, you know, old white dude had just only heard about, which is he is the victim of a driving while black stop. Basically, he and his wife are going out, and then he's stopped basically just because he's black and right. humiliated by the cops. And I think Dylan's the other cop, right? He's one of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he's the one, he's like, this scene I remember pretty vividly. It's like he's feeling his wife up and saying all sorts of nasty stuff and like humiliating them. It's a really, really right. rough scene.
And so that was one of those that I was like, holy Jesus, they're not shying away from this. Okay. But I feel like that was the last, like, I don't know, subtle's not the right word, but I say that a lot in sure. this show. Subtle's not the right word. Maybe that's our motto. Subtle is not the right word.
Well,
but I think
don't
that
pick
was
a lot of subtle movies. So maybe it's our fault.
Well, but yeah, I feel like that's the last kind of moment in the movie where things sort of speak for themselves, and then the rest of the movie is kind of, by memory, of course, I've only seen it once, it's sort of sending home this agenda of like, but no, you think he's bad, but really he's got his good points too. It's the Trump thing where it's like, no, but there's good people on both sides. Yeah, I know. Well, he's a racist sure. and he felt up a woman and he'll never see justice for that, but he does good things too. He's a cop, right? So...
Well, if I recall, and this is a bit of a spoiler for Crash, I suppose, there's really like, what's interesting is it's this huge ensemble film with all these people and all these interweaving stories, but I only remember like one story.
Is it the mysterious bullet?
I don't even remember that. I just remember this Matt Dillon thing. I remember he's a shitty cop. He feels this woman up. And then later on in the movie, she's in a car crash.
Right.
Where she's dying or something, or about to die.
I mean, he needs rescuing.
He runs in and saves her life.
Yes, he risks his life for hers.
Yeah, so it's this weirdly ironic, like, oh, the man who assaulted me also saved my life. Aren't we all good and bad? And, you know, what? Like, that was sort of like the vibe of the movie. That's all I remember. I couldn't even tell you one of the other stories of the movie.
Well,
but there, it's all kind of like that.
Yes. There is one story, and I think this is the one that a lot of people's opinions hinge on. Like, is this a good movie? Is this a treacly movie? Is this a hack movie? It all seems to border around this scene. Now, not for you, obviously, because you don't even remember it, but there's this whole scene where, like, through these weird series of events, somebody gets their hand on a gun, aims it at a kid, right? Or the kid, or aims it at a guy, and the kid gets
shot. Fire? Okay.
The gun goes off, but because of all these mysterious other events that have been sort of falling like dominoes in the background, the bullet doesn't hit, and it's like, oh my God, what a miracle. And it's like, no, it was a blank. But it's this magic, like, oh my God, the bullet didn't hit. It's my son was saved, or what. I don't remember if it's a boy or a girl child. But it's supposed to be this magic moment, but it's also been a planted real moment. And a lot of people, I think, saw that coming because they heard the word, oh, there's a blank somewhere in this movie. And it's like, and then when a gun showed up, they're like, well, I know there's a blank in this movie somewhere, so I bet this is it. And so then when it didn't happen, a lot of people were like, yeah, that's real smart. But other people were taken by it. Other people were like, oh, my God, I forgot all about the blank. That's amazing.
So it's not inexplicable like something, like, let's say, Pulp Fiction. That has a similar moment where, you know, arc heroes or anti-heroes get sort of shot at and magically missed. And they kind of look around confused and then return fire. This is like... there's a plot in the movie that explains why there's no gunshot.
Right.
But the characters don't know.
Yes, I believe the characters don't. I mean, or they don't.
I have no memory of this.
See, that to me is the funny thing, because most people who didn't like the film usually cited that scene to me. They'd be like, oh, my God, the bullet, the gun scene. Oh, my God, dude.
Well, speaking of not liking and liking the movie, maybe this is a good time to talk about, like, when did you see this movie? It sounds like it, but from your intro, it sounds like you saw it before Oscar season or something.
Yeah, I believe I saw it because I remember specifically my wife and I going on a date. Now, I may be, you know, the my memory being what it is, I may be putting something on it. Maybe we went on a date that wasn't around our anniversary, but I believe the movie came out around our anniversary, which was in May. And I think we went to see it as part of our, oh, it's our anniversary, let's go see a movie. And so we saw it around when it came out. I don't think it was like first weekend or anything because we were the only ones in the theater, but we saw it. Like I said, it was one of those nights where it's just like, oh, this has just been a good night. And then we saw the movie and I was like, oh, well, this is, you know, this is fine. Oh, there's some smart stuff. And I will maintain this. So people will shit on this movie, but I think the trouble with the movie is there's a lot of great actors. There's a lot of good acting. There's a lot of technical prowess. There's a lot of good things going. It's like an M. Night Shyamalan movie, right? It's like there's an amazing amount of talent being used. Does the story live up to it is basically the question. For some people, it does not. For me at the time, it was like, oh, that's fine. I'm enjoying this. It doesn't, you know, hit me in the treacle or whatever, you know, was people's problems. But then Oscar season came around and people start and the big secret in LA is it's a movie about Los Angeles, and people love movies about Los Angeles who live in Los Angeles, including me, so I am guilty as well. But also movie companies around Oscar season, movie studios will send out what they call screeners, and most of you probably know this, but if you're in, like, if you're working in the industry to any capacity, you will sometimes get these screeners. Like I'm in the Writers Guild and I'm in the Editors Guild, and so I get these screeners for movies every year and TV shows. And they pimped that movie like nobody's business. I forget, was it Miramax? I forget. I think it might have
been.
This
was their whole thing. They would just open their wallet for. But
yes,
for
they would movies. Just like when Oscar season came, they would just spend shitloads of money to get it. So like you couldn't go anywhere in LA without knowing Crash is the movie. This is it. For Oscar season, Crash is your guy. They made sure every voting member of the Academy saw this movie in one way or another. And for whatever reason, you know, if people liked it or didn't watch any other movies or, you know, whatever, it was everybody's third choice. It won the Oscar. And that started. I mean, the backlash had already started, of course, because people were angry that it even got nominated. And then once it won, people were like, oh my God, this piece of shit movie is terrible. And I was like, I felt bad for both sides because I was like, well, I liked it when it came out, but I'm also kind of glad that it's getting shit on. You know, I'm that total like turncoat. I'm the guy who's like, you know, I liked it, but I don't care.
Well, it's interesting because I don't receive screeners or anything. And although I do live in Los Angeles and I obviously follow the Oscars as a thing, but this was a movie that I didn't see when it came out or was released in theaters or anything, but it was nominated for Best Picture. So as this is why they pay all this money, I was like, oh, well, obligatorily, I will view this movie so that I'm up to speed on my Oscar pool when I gamble on the Oscars.
So it worked, is what you're saying. It the money worked.
Yeah. So I ticked it off the list and watched it for the Oscars, and I remember thinking it was okay. I feel like you said, this movie, what's interesting, you describe a film that you thought was okay and that people raved about and that you were sort of annoyed by them raving. My experience, this movie has always been talked about in a fuck this movie kind of way with almost everyone I know. So maybe this is just like, I don't know, the people I rub shoulders with or something, but like, I heard it was shitty. Like I was basically, the word on the street for me was like, Crash sucks and it shouldn't be nominated. So I was like, well, okay, I'll watch it. And so given that reception pre-reception, this movie's gonna suck. I remember watching it and being like, well, this is fine. Like I remember it being like a functional, fine movie.
Right.
That I didn't dislike. I thought I enjoyed parts of it. And I thought it was fine. I agree with the general feeling of like, well, this is not actually the best picture of the year, obviously. Right. And then in a way, my biggest takeaway from it was it seemed like a simpler version of a type of movie that most people don't usually see that I remember. Things like Amores Perros or, you know, whatever. Like these Magnolia, these kind of like big bouquet of little slices of stories of intersecting people. That's a very common thing in like indie films, in foreign films, and like had never really hit the mainstream in that way.
Right. I guess there's that.
You could say maybe Heat or something, I guess, if you know, it's just similar. That's following like a couple of people.
Right.
But this is definitely that, like, you know, paying it forward, like this person affects this person and that whole thing.
Right.
And so that was my read on it, was I was like, oh, this is taking like Amores Perros, but like doing a popcorn version of that, like a way more accessible, easy to digest version for mainstream audiences.
Right.
And I think from what I can tell, it seemed to go over well. I mean, it won Best Picture, and I think most people, you know, you're just like kind of average person, seems to like the movie. But all my film snob friends are like, fuck this movie. So I'm coming into this like, I remember liking it, but it has this stain of like being like super shitty or whatever. And I actually really want to, it's been many years, I mean, well over a decade now since that movie came out.
Yes, I mean, it's been 16 years? So yes. I haven't seen it since that, you know, first month.
To be perfectly clear, the idea of a movie about race relations in the United States at the time it came out, you know, I mean, obviously it's made by a white man, written by a white ex-Scientologist, was a Scientologist at the time.
Yeah.
Man, and so I don't think it's going to be a very subtle or well-informed view of racism, but just the idea that someone was like even covering that at that time, it wasn't terribly in vogue then.
Yeah.
And people kind of walked away from it being like, well, isn't race tough or whatever. And I'm curious now, you know, now we're here on it's now 2021.
Right.
And we're in a very different reality now. I mean, it's a very same reality for a lot of people, but for, you know, white men like us,
for old moneyed white cis dudes
who have woken up from the Matrix and been, oh wow, things are bad.
Oh my god, you mean there's people who don't that aren't treated equally in this country? Yeah. I'm appalled.
What? Holy crap! I'm very curious, like how it would play now, specifically with race.
I wonder if it This is the thing. It's like at the time when we thought we were very evolved, again, old white dudes who, you know, had already conquered racism. At the time, there was an element that seemed like, well, yeah, this is just sort of, I don't know, not pedantic, not exactly condescending, but it's sort of like preaching to the choir.
It was sort of
like, yes, we all get it. Racism's bad. And, oh, yes, people are people. Good job. But I wonder now if it's like you watch it now. It's like, well, we laughed at it then, but it's like obviously we weren't as evolved as we thought we were. So maybe we were, you know, preaching to the choir wasn't exactly what it was doing.
Because the reaction you're talking about, you know, the thing you said, you and Allie were sort of like, oh, yeah, racism is bad. Duh. Like, of course. Thanks, movie. We don't need to know this. We already know this. Like, that is a sentiment that I think makes sense in the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
But, like, you're right. Like, looking back, it's like, well, I don't know. Maybe there's more to that story than... we were giving it credit for it.
Maybe we needed our noses rubbed in it a little bit more just to make sure. Well, it's, you know,
I don't know.
You say you're above this, but
I don't know. We could watch it and just laugh at it and be like, well, this is ridiculous. I don't know. Cause that's the other, I do remember it being very unsubtle. Like it was just bluntly almost, you sort of evoked patronizing. I think that's a good term. Like it did kind of feel like my first racism movie. So I'm curious. I'm like super curious because will my perspective have changed to the point where I view the movie differently? I don't think the movie's changed.
Right.
I'm more wondering, have I changed to the point where I'm going to receive this differently?
Yeah. Well, it certainly is going to be interesting for this movie to be the underdog. You know, it's very rare that an Oscar winning best picture is like the underdog when you go into it knowing like, well, people think this movie's terrible, so, you know, it can only go up, right? So it may even get that like subtle bump of like, well, it's not as bad as people say it is.
Well, it's got to be an interesting movie to say the least, because I mean, we're sitting here saying, oh, it has a rep of being bad or a rep of being great. Like I know plenty of people that love this movie. I know plenty of people that hate this movie. I know plenty of people that are like, eh.
Like, so, who gives a shit? Yeah, exactly.
It seems to run the gamut. So I'm curious
like
where it will land. But speaking of where it might land, perhaps now, Mr. Nelson, it's time to make our wager. So do you think the Crash will 2004 Crash will hold up?
I'm going to shoot the moon, Longino. I'm going to say it holds up. I have nothing to base this on, but let's be positive. It's a new year. Let's take and let's learn the lessons that we didn't learn in 2004. Hold up, Crash 2004. Okay. Do it.
You think it's going to hold up? Well, I very much admire your positive attitude, and I do agree we are in a time where we need a little more positivity. I also don't think it's going to hold up.
Well,
because fuck it, some crazy Scientologist wrote this movie. Come on, like there's no way it's gonna be that good.
That's the funny, because I remember at the time Paul Haggis had written Million Dollar Baby, which I had really enjoyed.
Right. And that was good.
And I think it came out before this movie. My memory is it came out before this movie because I was like, oh, that's the guy who wrote Million Dollar Baby. And so then this movie came out in his career, like, you know, not up and down, I guess, because it's like depending on who you ask, he's awesome or he's terrible. And then he just became known as like the ex-Scientologist. I know he still works. He still writes a shitload. But like,
well, he very famously wrote like an op-ed and about him leaving Scientology and stuff. So.
But he's certainly, he's on the one hand, it's like he's become more famous for being an ex-Scientologist. On the other hand, it's like, maybe that's a good thing. I guess we'll find out. I mean, but I do remember thinking to myself at the stuff that I saw, and I don't remember what else he's written, but we'll look it up for next segment. But I do remember thinking that whenever I saw a Paul Haggis movie, I was like, oh, there are these character beats that he always examines that other writers don't tend to. It's, you know, more 70s, I guess, is, you know, the general feeling of it. I should also say, but you know, again, I think I said it before, but I do think part of the reason this movie, you know, if the writing is not what sold it, I think the acting is like probably the next level thing that it needed to win all the awards. Because like when you have like all these great actors like Don Cheadle and, you know, Terrence Howard and whatnot, I remember them being good, even if what they're saying isn't necessarily worthy of their performance. I remember their performances being great because I was like, even Ludacris, he's like, he's one of those guys that's like, I get a kick out of Ludacris, but I don't think to myself, oh man, that's the guy. And yet even in this movie, he's like, oh, he's turning in a good performance. This guy's, you know, he's better than I thought. That's great. So
You know what? Before we start, I should mention, you mentioned Ludacris, and another scene I remember just popped into my head. Where okay. If I recall, the movie begins with Ludacris giving a whole speech about how he feels like someone was judging him as being like a criminal or something.
Right.
He's yes. sort of like, how dare they? Oh, that's right. typical or whatever. And then I think he pulls a gun out and it's
and
like,
and then his sidekick says, like, basically,
yeah.
he's like, they're acting like I'm going to rob him. And his sidekick says, but you are going to rob him.
Right.
Wah, wah, wah. Yeah.
So it is this weird irony of like,
is it wah, or is it real? Is it good? I don't know.
That's an interesting take. And I guess we'll find out
I guess
whether
so.
It holds up or not.
Okay.
So, all right, Mr. Nelson, without further ado, put the keys in the ignition, hit the gas, and let's go watch Crash.
2004.
It's the sense of touch. Any real city, you walk, you know? You brush past people, people bump into you. In L.A., nobody touches you. We're always behind this metal and glass.
How far can bullets go?
You thinking about that bullet that came through your window?
I am angry all the time, and I don't know why.
Put your hands on top of your head, man.
Will you just do what he says?
Now, do you have any guns or knives or anything I might get stuck with?
It's your brother's file. Kid's going away for life for stealing a cart.
All I need to do to make this disappear is to frame a potentially innocent man.
Did you find your brother?
Oh.
Tell him to come home.
What I need is a husband who will not just there.
What did you want me to do? Get us both shot?
Get out of the car!
Give me the keys!
I just had a gun pointed in my face. And it was my fault because I knew it was gonna happen.
Heads in plain sight, step out of the vehicle.
Honey, stay inside.
Man, don't walk up on me.
I know this man.
Get back.
Now you're it's the sense of touch. I think we miss that touch so much. That we crash into each other just so we can feel something.
Something else, money?
People, man. People.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back from Crash. How you doing, Mr. Nelson?
Oh, I'm just feeling that electric guitar at the end, but... I can't get over this snow in L.A. It's an amazing thing.
Well, it's weird. They do a fake-out snow where I guess it's actually ash from a burning car, so that made sense. And then they just show real snow.
Yeah, then like, they show real snow, yeah.
Because at first I was like, oh, snow in L.A., that's impossible. And I was like, oh, okay, that's clever. It's ash from a burning car. And then I was like, oh, and then... And I guess it's just really snowing. So.
But then it really snowed. And
you can have it every which way. So there you go.
Well, funny you should put it that way. That's if if I was to point to the flaw of the movie, it wanted it every which way.
Yes, that is a good way to put it.
I feel like very similar to the last time I saw this. I feel like each individual story taken on its own and placed in another movie is pretty good. However, the sum of the parts all put together in one movie don't sort of add up to a whole, I think.
Sure. Well, I think the movie is really dabbling with some interesting concepts like...
Yes.
Sort of. So, first and foremost, let's diffuse the judgment of like this was Beck's picture of the year at the Oscars. I think
yeah.
both you and I can very easily agree like, we would not nominate this best film of the entire year of 2004 or whenever it came out.
No, but so, I feel like I can see why people would like go, oh, this is like my third best movie because, again, the
performances
are great. I feel like the technical aspects of the movie are pretty good. It's just that what is it adding up to? I'm not
100%
sure.
Right. Well, now watching it again, I'm really struck by, I had right before we recorded, remember this irony of like Ludacris complains about he's being racially profiled and then is a thug with a gun, like robbing people and stuff.
Right.
And that really can extrapolate to the entire film. Like the sort of premise of the movie seems to be, we're going to start you somewhere and we're going to sort of surprise your expectations with pretty much almost everyone, except maybe, I think Michael Pena is the only like squeaky clean gets out of it just basically being a decent guy without, I don't think he has a moment where he's bad. Like he's right. Just a nice, great, good father, a nice guy.
Right.
But pretty much everyone else in the movie, there's this kind of arc to everyone where like, if you started out a shitty scumbag, we're going to wrap you up with like, maybe you're not as bad as we thought, or it kind of seems like people are complicated. The movie, right? we're yes. So used to like good guys, bad guys. This person's a nice person. This person's an awful person.
Right.
I think what the movie's doing that is interesting is this idea of like, you know what? Human beings are all of these things. They're mean. They're nice. They're awful. They're great. And we're going to take everyone and kind of show you a potpourri of the human experience. So the people that you deem as bad are going to do good things. The people you deem as good are going to do bad things. And I'm going to sort of challenge you on this. Paul Haggis is as the writer and director. Like, I'm going to challenge your expectations of who people are in movies or in a story. And I think that's an interesting thing to try, where I think it's sort of, to your point of like, it doesn't quite come together, is I have a hard time buying that in like a 2-day period.
Right.
Like people are complicated in their lives, right? Like
yes,
over right. The span of decades, not like you don't go from a squeaky clean LAPD cop who's concerned his partner is too racist to like literally the next day murdering a man. Like that's
right.
That's a huge change in character. So Ryan Phillippe, who I'm referring to, is Matt Dillon's partner. And
right.
they sort of do this weird role reversal in the movie where like initially Matt Dillon is the piece of shit racist cop who we hate. And Ryan Phillippe is the squeaky clean nice guy. Right.
Right.
And they essentially reverse roles over the course. I think they are the most extreme like in the movie, so that's why I'm using them as an example.
Right.
But by day two, Matt Dillon is a hero rescuing a woman from a burning car, the same woman he molested.
Right.
And Ryan Phillippe, who has made this whole point of like he wants to whistleblow racism within his own department. And then literally the next day, he's sort of racially profiling a guy who is a hitchhike he picked up, who was a character throughout the movie with Ludacris.
Right. And well, again, he's the guy who helped Ludacris rob, carjack.
Right.
He also happens to be the brother of Don Cheadle, who happens,
yeah,
you know,
I mean yeah,
everybody's got these
kind of
3 and 4 connections.
Yeah. It's like a Mobius strip of a movie where everything kind of connect. Unless your name's Sandra Bullock, where I guess you're just depressed in a house by yourself. That's really all she had.
Right.
But like, that's the thing. By the end of it, Ryan Phillippe is a murderer. Like,
yes.
He literally murders this guy because he's concerned that he thinks he's going to kill him or whatever. And that's the thing. I think this guy was literally running from the cops prior. It's like, in order to make this make sense, people take actions and do things that definitely bend, if not break, suspension of disbelief.
Sure. Yeah.
Like that whole thing of that scene with Ryan Phillippe, the guy's like, oh, you want to see what's, he's like, hey, freeze, don't move. Like, show me your hands. He's like, you want to see what's in my pocket? Oh, I'll show you what's in my pocket. Like in the most I'm about to murder you voice.
Yeah, it's like, would you like to see like, my gun that I'm about to pull out? Because that's what I'm about to do, honky.
And like, what's weird is like anyone who's told, hey, show me your hands, don't move, it doesn't then utter the most threatening, most I'm going to kill you thing. They would probably, that's the problem. Like people sort of, to make the point of the movie, people behave in a way that's a little like, unrealistic. I think especially like Terrence Howard, who doesn't stand up to Matt Dillon molesting his wife, decides to like suddenly be in GTA and like run around. And, like,
yeah, that was of all of them. That was the one where the suspension of disbelief. I couldn't go that far with that.
There's
one.
This scene where he's like practically doing suicide by cop. And you're just like, what? This is a man who, like, the night before was too afraid to say so much as, hey, stop that, to Matt Dillon. And I guess that's the point, right? He's repressed, like, he didn't stand
right,
up
but,
or something.
But
so
but
now
by,
he's exploding in craziness.
But like, he's already kind of made the point. The point has already, you know, the arc has been made when, like, Terrence Howard, who, again, the night before watched his wife get molested by a cop and didn't do anything. One of the most realistic scenes in the whole movie where
right.
it's like, he and his wife
just has
are,
to eat it.
Yeah, he has to fucking stand there and watch this cop, you know, feel up his wife and stick his fucking finger in whichever orifice he found, which was just disgusting. And then
it's pretty awful. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's terrible. And you're watching it and you're totally uncomfortable, but you totally understand. Look, if he makes the wrong move, Matt Dillon shoots him and says, hey, man, he came at me. What was I supposed to do?
Right.
And, you know, even back then you could tell, like, well, of course, you know, if a black man stopped by a cop, then the cop can shoot him at whatever point he wants, a white cop. Now it's even more pronounced. I mean, Thandi knew it. I mean, this is pure coincidence, but I, you know, it's telling that, like, at the point where Thandi Newton is being rescued by Matt Dillon from the burning car, she says, I can't breathe, which has become one of the most famous,
right.
you know, Black Lives Matter related, you know, utterances. It's like, and again, how could he have predicted? But at the same point, it's like, well, it's such a common, you know,
sure.
problem. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Obviously an unintentional coincidence, but,
right.
it's,
but still,
it is interesting.
Still speaks to something. And then for Terrence Howard to then, you know, he's had his moment, you know, of humiliation. His wife is not being helpful because she's been humiliated as well, and she's taking it out on him unfairly, perhaps. And then the carjackers try to take his car, and he's finally had an, he's also had a shitty day at work where he's been confronted with, you know, very societal, systematic racism, but, you know, not nearly as overt, but still just as painful and humiliating. And then the carjackers come after him. He's like, well, I've had enough of this shit. And he just goes nuts and beats the shit out of him, which is great. But then he gets into, like you say, you know, the cops see them fighting. He jumps in the car with Ludacris. They're, you know, trying to avoid. I mean, it's the point is made. It's like he beats up the carjackers, either gets shot or doesn't, you know. That's the story right there. Him being then pursued by cops and him saying, well, I've had enough of this shit, and about to like get a gun down by cops. It's like, okay, this is like three steps past the line of arc
sure.
and into sort of melodrama. And
yes.
and maybe that's what we're sort of reacting to, is like there would be these great moments of like drama, human drama and character moments where they are really, you know, he's died. No shit, Paul Haggis is digging into human character as deeply as he can, but then he takes it like almost always one or two steps like further than necessary, you know. And I think the accumulation
right. it's fairly heavy handed.
That's well, yeah,
in the just amount of this that kind of comes at
right.
you.
And I think part of it is just the sheer accumulation of misery and sorrow and racism and bad coincidence, you know, that everything coming together, you're just, I think part of what people are reacting to is it's too much, you know what I mean? It feels like, even though I, like I say, if you pulled out each individual story and
sure.
really honed it in another movie, I feel like that would be the thing that people are like, oh my God, did you see that like Terrence Howard subplot where he and his wife tried to go out? That would be the thing that people pointed to as like, that's, oh, that's fucking masterful. But it just is so much. So, yeah.
Right, and it's a very tough needle to thread. I talked about this before, that there are other of these kind of ensemble serendipity movies where like multiple plots are sort of crossing, pollinating amongst themselves into a movie. You know, I gave the example of Magnolia or Amores Perros or something. There's something about, let's say, the P.T. Anderson film Magnolia, I think is a phenomenal movie. I know some people aren't maybe that into it, but I adore it, right?
I haven't seen it but the one time, and that would be a holdup for me, but anyway.
Oh, sure. Well, hey, maybe another time. But as an example, that is a movie where there are multiple plots going on that thread in and out of themselves, and the characters connect to each other in loose and interesting ways. And it's also a movie about the human experience, human condition. It's not really tackling racism or prejudice in any kind of strong way, but it's definitely a depressing movie with people who have lots of problems and stuff.
Right.
And I think you can do that. When it works best is when it's sort of emotionally and thematically connected, but not so much super literally crossing so much. Like,
yeah,
like the Magnolia version is like everyone's kind of 6 degrees separated, right? So there's connections from different characters. Oh, this person is this person's father. Oh, this person, you know, is here taking care of them in this moment or whatever. Right. But they're not. I think Crash does it a little too much.
Yeah.
To the point where as someone who just, you know, has a scientific mind, I'm just like, this is literally impossible. Like, this is crazy.
Right.
So for example, it's like the Terrence Howard, Thandie Newton, Matt Dillon, Ryan Phillippe circle. They meet in this one moment, this intense moment where he molests his wife, right? And then it's like, if you're going to have a serendipity, you only get one. There's no right. way you can have two. So to have Matt Dillon rescue his wife from a burning car.
Right.
Which is already super melodramatic, right? Like, a car is on fire. She had an accident and whatever. It happens the same exact day her husband goes GTA crazy in the streets of LA.
Right.
And then gets pulled over by the same other cop that was also just there yesterday. Like, that's impossible. Like, that's right. beyond coincidence. And just like, this literally wouldn't happen. And the movie's like very like that. Like,
yeah,
everything
is woven together that way. It's
and I like little connections, like, oh, hey, did you, and they do some of those, like, the daughter of the Persian store owner who purchases him his gun happens to be work at a hospital. And she's there when Don Cheadle is viewing his dead brother's body, right?
Right.
And there's no connection beyond just like she's just working there. I like those kind of connections,
right?
But the whole like the same four people interact the next day out of coincidence is just kind of wild to me. But you can almost sort of forgive it because it's like, well, that's the movie. It's the sort of serendipity, everything's connected movie. And it's more in the service of the theme than it is like some kind of magic trick. But
I mean, a magic trick is a good way to look at it. After once or twice of those, you start looking for where the magician's putting his hands. And right. I don't think he is subsequently hiding his hands as much. You know what I mean? I feel like a magician is like, yeah, look over here. Now look over here.
Right.
I'm distracting you constantly.
Or a magician, the big rule of a magic trick is don't do the same trick more than once, right?
Right.
Like, because you'll just keep seeing how it's done. I mean, obviously this isn't literally a magic trick, but it's the same thing. It's like, hey, look, here's this guy and this guy. Can you believe it?
Yes.
Hey, look, here's this. Can you believe it? Oh, my God, it's his brother. It's the same cop.
You've seen it a few times, then your brain starts to kick in and be like, okay, who's going to meet next? What serendipitous thing?
You can sort of anticipate it.
Yeah,
sure.
So then when it doesn't sort of like add up to, a greater total, then you're like, oh, well, okay, I see you. It was just a series of serendipitous moments.
My big question, I'm actually really curious, because this is a movie of multiple plots.
Right.
And I'm curious if we have the same or different for you. What were the like stories that were strong for you that you liked, and what were the ones that were weak that maybe you didn't like?
That's a good question. I liked
best and worst, if you had to
right.
pick it, I don't
know. Terrence Howard was up there. He and Thandie Newton did, you know, phenomenal performing, phenomenal theme, you know. I mean, even given like say the, you know, Matt Dillon rescuing her from a burning car the next day. To me, that's like the ultimate expression of this movie. It's like the dude who molested her the night before saves her life, and not only saves her life, knows who it is he's rescuing, has to do it in a way that requires her to basically allow him to rescue her, you know, and in a semi-intimate way. And I thought that was really well done. But then you're right, the same day is GTA with Terrence Howard. So it's like, well, that sort of lessens things a bit. The Ryan Phillippe plot may be actually my least favorite because he's sort of the most heavy-handed one, I feel like.
Sure.
Because he's like, oh, he's the good cop who's going to ultimately do the worst thing. And it's sort of like, well, okay, but there wasn't any, you know, kind of shades of gray you could find besides that. I just felt like that was just the most like, we're going all the way from A to Z and it doesn't matter what his character is. I don't know. That one, I think maybe that one's my least favorite.
Sure.
I would say I like Don Cheadle's performance. I thought, and the story he was kind of, the arc he was kind of on, or the story he was on, the story that Don Cheadle was following was actually based, I believe, on a true story, which is, and this is what sort of kicked off the Rampart investigation, or one of the many things that kicked off the Rampart investigation in Los Angeles. There was this shootout in the streets of LA between these two, you know, gangbangers, quote unquote. Cops come to the scene, they start examining, and they realize, oh, this guy over here, he's an undercover cop. Oh, well, the gangbanger shot an undercover cop. They go over to the gangbanger. Oh, shit, the other gangbanger's an undercover cop. Two undercover cops were shooting each other. And not because they were trying to arrest one another for, you know, for breaking the law. No, neither of them was enforcing the law. They were playing their parts, their undercover roles, and shooting at each other. And that's sort of what happens in this movie. And Don Cheadle's investigating that, and they raise a lot of interesting questions that I'm like, well, this is almost to me more interesting than a lot of the other like human plots that are going on, which, and sure, it's not really that kind of a movie, honestly, but that was more interesting to me. And then when that sort of, you know, had its moment and went away, I was like, oh man, I sort of wish that had more space.
What's interesting that you bring up Don Cheadle, I wasn't so much as interested in the sort of plot of the cops and their murder and stuff, although right, that was sort of like interesting in terms of how it connects to Rampart. But in more specifically with Don Cheadle, I think he was my favorite story because it was the most like grounded and realistic story.
Sure.
Yeah. For the most part. I mean, specifically having to do with his own family life and his mom in particular. Now, maybe I gravitate towards this because I have my own mom problems or something. So that's the one that speaks to me. I'm sure this is like a litmus test movie of right, like, hey, whichever one you go for is right, your problem. But to me, all his problems were the rest of the movie has very melodramatic stuff, right?
Yes.
He re-molests her and then she's in a burning car. That's very melodramatic. He's a good cop and then he murders a man. Very melodramatic. Don Cheadle was like kind of grounded and realistic. His problems were like, I am a police officer and my mother is a drug abuser and loves me but has problems. And right, so I have these personal problems. And then my brother has this life of crime and stuff. And his issues were like, I'm being offered a promotion within the Justice Department of Los Angeles, you know, to maybe come work for the DA's office. But the guy who's offering me this job is kind of racist and patronizing.
Right.
And do I compromise the truth for my own career? And his mom, I think, in particular, the scene with him that I really liked, because it was really tough, was when they're identifying his dead brother.
Right.
And you've seen him like come in and take care of his mom and check the refrigerator and like try, he obviously cares.
Right. Bought her groceries. She, yeah.
Yeah. And then she just decides to break his heart by blaming his brother's death directly on him.
Right.
She's basically like, I asked you to bring him home. You know whose fault this is? Your fault. And right, then she says this very sad, like, oh, you know what? He came and visited me and took care of me. She's like so fucking out of it. She didn't realize that was him. There was something about that that was just sad and well done and just very, that's like a real life, real person problem.
Right.
Yes. I mean, obviously it's a little melodramatic because his brother was killed, but like mom problems, I could relate to. And then on the flip side, I liked the story they were telling, but it was just, there was just not enough of it. The whole like Sandra Bullock story was yeah, just really a throwaway. It was like, as an editor, I'd almost just cut it out of the movie. Like,
yeah,
I don't know if they're trying to tick some box. Like basically Sandra Bullock's whole thing was like, I'm a housewife to a DA who's lonely and sad and angry, and
she's the
I'm
ultimate Karen.
I'm just an angry white woman yelling at my maid, entitled and rich, and I'm actually just alone and sad. And she has this weird thing where, like, she just falls down the stairs, and none of her friends come pick her up, but she's fine. And, like, maybe Brendan Fraser, her husband, is having an affair. Maybe, like, they don't close the book on that. He obviously doesn't care that much about her. I think that could have been interesting. They just really didn't develop it.
And everything to do with that storyline, it's like you could almost lift that her character and Brendan Fraser's character wholesale out, because, again, I could see what he's doing, which is like, well, I'm trying to show every character who is involved in this what their particular set of issues are. Whereas, Sandra Bullock, it's like, that's a very realistic thing, but it's like, for her to be like, oh, I fell down the stage. I gotta say, of all the ones, because she's doing a great job too. Sandra Bullock, not usually playing an unlikable character.
Yeah, she's like practically wasted in this movie. Because Sandra Bullock is fantastic, and she gets like two scenes.
Gets very little time. And then she basically is angry the first part of the movie, unreasonably racist about the guy who's coming to change their locks. Which is sort of like, there's a lot of like people who speak their mind a little too much, because that's like, I understand there's racism and, you know, systematic racism and unacknowledged racism, but everybody felt really comfortable speaking their minds at times when I was like, I don't even think. I don't buy it. But her especially, hers is almost the one that's the most laughable, because it's like, she is on the phone with her friend and she has her little arc. She realizes, oh, I woke up thinking I was angry about the car wreck, and then the carjacking, and then I just realized, oh, I'm angry all the time. I'm just an angry person, and I don't know why. And you're like, oh, that's cool, interesting character beat. And then she immediately slips and falls down the stairs, like the second she gets off the phone saying this. And it's like, in the moment, it's not like I burst out laughing, but in my head, I was like, okay, see, that's gilding the lily right there. That's the thing on top, the hat on the hat, you know what I mean? It's like a thing on top of a thing on top of a thing. It's right. Like, that's the thing that reality producers say. It's like, no, we really need to milk this moment. It's like, we need to have a series of events happen to really
signposting.
Yeah. Where it's like, no, you're just really adding just one thing on top of another that's really not that related.
No, you're totally right. Like, it was a wrap when she had that realization. I'm angry all the time. That's all you need. You don't need this. Like,
and then maybe
downstairs.
She's nice to her maid just because she's realized she's angry. No, the maid has to come to her rescue off screen even. And then they're friends by the end and hugging. And it's like, that honestly, that looked just more like, oh, they really only had Sandra Bullock for 2 days, didn't they? You know what I mean? It's like they had to tell the whole story in like two shooting days.
And I will say the most emotionally just cheap an easy thing, which I will confess did affect me, is this whole Michael Pena daughter story. Because when I first saw that, this is the biggest difference. When I first saw this movie, I didn't have a kid.
Right.
This was years ago. I was not even in, I wasn't married or whatever. Now I have the daughter in the movie is like my daughter's age. So it was like almost unfair. Like I was so, so unbelievably affected.
Right.
By these scenes with this little girl. They've moved from a bad neighborhood. My daughter's at like the nightmare stage where I'm having to calm her down and get her to back to bed, and she's afraid and all this stuff. So to have this scene with this girl who's like afraid of bullets, oh my God, the gunshot that happened in my house. And he tells this whole long story about, oh, my invisible Harry Potter robe is going to protect you and stuff. And then to have that's also a bridge too far. Like, I understand this guy's shop got ripped off or whatever, but the idea that he's going to like grab a gun and go kill the locksmith was a little, I think he thinks that he robbed him or something, but like,
well, they didn't do a very good job of
it's a little much.
Yeah. Well, it's again, this guy is just like the guy who gets robbed just immediately. And he's an angry guy too. It's like, he immediately just jumps to the angriest, most racist conclusion.
Now I'm a murderer. But the joke is like, you literally told me before the movie starts, there's a thing with blanks in a gun. I know the gun has blanks in it, and I'm still like, there's a scene with a little girl and a revolver and men screaming, and she runs out and the gun. And it was just like horrifying because, and the first time I was like, oh, well, that's unfortunate. But like, as a father now, it's like your worst fear in the entire world.
That
your child is going to get hurt.
Michael Pena selling that moment.
Yeah, he was great. I mean,
that's
he's
only
great
good
actor.
Thing that came out of that. I mean, again, because I not only did I see it, you know, I knew it was coming this time and I told you all about it, but like knowing it was coming and being like, okay, she's still, but, and I was still like, this is trying to wrench my heartstrings. I know what the scene is trying to do, and he still sells it. Just the anguish when he doesn't even feel it. That's the best part. It's like his daughter has leaped into his arms. He's heard the gunshot go off, and all it did is just like focus on his face, just this long close-up on his screaming face, and it takes him a long time to realize that his daughter is fine.
Yes.
And that to me is just like, okay, even when I know the magician is manipulating me, this guy is selling it for all he's worth. And again, that was this whole movie, is like the actors were like really bringing everything home. They were I don't know if they're better than he deserved, but they were certainly like they picked the right people for the job because everybody was doing their job correct.
And absolutely.
Even when they didn't have the best material, they made it good material. So, yeah, I can see why people would like tick this box off and say, oh, okay, well, this isn't my favorite, but it's definitely my second, third, fourth favorite, and it just got enough fourths.
Well, it was that whole daughter thing was deeply affecting. I mean, as a parent, like, that's your absolute worst fear in the entire world.
Right.
Just easily. Like, I can't think of anything more nightmarish than, like, my daughter shot in my arms trying to protect me or whatever. Like, and so what I recognize that it's easy. it's like, yeah, anyone can do that. Anyone can take like the most horrifying thing that could possibly happen and show it to you and affect you.
Right.
But I'd be sitting here lying if I said I wasn't like affected by it. Like, I just could not help but think of my own child and be like, oh my God.
Well, it should have been even so affecting that the guy who shot the gun, who has his own grown daughter at that point, who he obviously loves very much, he, I feel like, should have been affected in a different way. His whole takeaway is that, oh, God, you know, the Pulp Fiction thing. God an reached angel. Down and stopped my bullets because I needed an angel, and there she was. I felt like that could have been explored more. It's like, oh, my God, I'd almost shot somebody's daughter. What am I? Who am I? What monster have I become?
The scene they didn't show is if I'm Michael Pena, and then that scene ends, and my daughter's fine, and I look, and she's alive. That I would immediately beat this man to death, like, just without a second's thought, be like, you fucking almost shot my daughter, and I would just like unload on him.
I think the factor that made me, because I was wondering about that, I was like, well, if they're blanks, but I realized, oh, well, the guy's still got a gun, and a misfire is entirely possible. So
sure.
As far
I
as
think
Michael
Pena
is
so stunned, he just walks inside.
Yeah, he walks inside. I believe Michael Pena because it's like, well, this guy still has a gun. Doesn't matter that the first bullet didn't work. All the rest could probably work fine. So
sure.
I see his point of view is fine for me. But I'm trying to think. There are a couple other stories in there that I'm trying to remember now. But Ludacris and Don Cheadle's brother run over, I believe, a Chinese man. They call him, derogatorily, they call him the Chinaman. But it turns out, they hit this poor guy in the middle of nowhere. And oh my God, what happened to him? And then he disappears for half the movie. You find him in the hospital, and then you find out, oh shit, he's a human trafficker. And you're like, well, that's kind of, I suppose.
Yeah, poor guy. That's sort of a weird thing because Ludacris is like riding the bus and sees an abandoned van that this guy got hit with and decides to steal it, takes it to the chop shop. They open it up. Oh my God, there's 20 people back here. And all I kept thinking is like, wait a minute.
You didn't notice that before?
God didn't see 20 people in the back of the van when he drove it for half an hour to like, where he's like, what? He didn't hear a cough?
Right.
He didn't hear a, excuse me, can you help us? We've been sitting here for 12 hours. Like, that is weird. Like,
yes.
He would see people in the car.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, again, a lot of convenient stuff has to happen for this movie to work as it works. So
right. And the other thing is like the guy he's at the chop shop he's selling cars to is so paranoid about police finding him that he watches CSI shows and knows like, okay, this has a speck of blood in it. Let's go burn it. They're never catching me. The same man sees a car full of people, says, hey, let's sell them. 50-50, you win. And then the next thing we know, Ludacris is just dropping them off on the street, freeing them. I'm like, wait a minute, the Chop Shop guy had nothing to say about this? Like, wouldn't
well,
he be
right.
linked to this crime? Like,
strange. The thing about that one is Ludacris's character is... Again, that's maybe one of those examples of taking it too far. It's like the whole thing about Ludacris's character in the beginning is that, oh, he's well-spoken, he's articulate, he's very, adamant about uplifting, his brethren and all. And then he turns out, oh, but he's a thug and a carjacker. Ha ha, isn't that ironic? But then for him to be like, well, he's a carjacker, but he would never carjack a black man because he says he wouldn't. And then he does by carjacking right. Terrence Howard. So he's already sort of... having these like hypocritical moments. So then when he's like presented with like the worst thing that could be presented, the fact that he's like, well, I'm not that bad a guy, it's like, that isn't
I'm not a human trafficker.
I'm not a trafficker. I don't sell human flesh. It's like, well, that I mean, good for him, but it's also sure. like, but that's not exactly a reversal of his character. You know what I mean? I can see a lot of people being like, right. I don't want any part of this.
Well, that's the thing. Again, it's like one step too far. It's not dissimilar to the Sandra Bullock fall down the stairs. It's like, to me, that his scene ended when Terrence Howard looked him in the eye in the car and said, you shame me,
right?
And you shame yourself. Like, he basically, the whole movie, this guy's been talking about how better he is.
Yes.
And how
uplift
much of a,
yes
yeah I'm here, he's just talking about like the struggle of the black man the whole movie, and hey, here's, you're blind, you're not seeing this, you're not seeing this. Literally every scene is him doing that. And then for Terrence Howard, a fellow black man, to look at him and be like, you are shaming me. Now, right. granted, Terrence Howard just went GTA crazy 5 minutes ago. So, like, I think it's interesting. He's maybe also, because he's also ashamed himself, obviously in a right. different way. But there is this sort of, they share this moment as two black men in shame.
Right.
And he just voices it and is like, you. And so to me, like, that was already his arc. Like, oh, yeah. The whole movie, I think I'm above all of this. And now this guy's calling me out like, no, you're not. In fact, dude, you're robbing people. Like, come on.
Right.
This is shameful. So he doesn't need, like, I find a car full of immigrants and set them free on the street. Like,
right.
like doves to the wind or whatever. that is a little... Yeah, it's just like, yeah, everything in the movie has that one extra step that's like a little too heavy-handed and a little too far.
Right.
But the concept's there, and I think the message is a good one. I really am left with the idea. I like people are complicated. This isn't cut and dry.
Right.
You can't really walk away, well, I love this guy, but I hate this girl. Or what? Everyone's kind of like, it had some good and bad moments. That. I like complicated.
Yeah, complicated. I feel like you could chop off probably most of the last 10, 15 minutes of the movie and still be left with most of the good stuff. I feel like the end is where things like really keep getting hammered. Like, he has like a WB or CW ending montage where, like, right. everybody reflects on what they've done.
To, like,
done.
A lyric up.
Yeah,
like,
as the snow...
Everyone tips their hat,
as the snow falls over L.A. and Luda lets the victims of human trafficking go on the streets of L.A., gives them money, sits in the truck, and I shit you not... smirks to himself. You know what I mean? Just like, that was totally right. like the end of a CW episode right there. So, right. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of stuff where it's like, oh, you had it. And it's almost like he didn't trust that, like, well, the movie about people being complicated needs itself to also be a little more complicated.
Right. And so. It has this cute button of like, look, a car crash. And here's the woman from the insurance company we saw earlier. And it's like, dude, I got it. Like, I don't need this like parable, to end on, as we show, look, it's the city and it's everybody. It's like, yeah, I know. Like, I know.
Well,
what
that's
you're
the thing is
tell.
Like, I mean, it should be more like, I don't know, you either like you start with the city in the beginning and you're like, oh, here's the city and here's everybody, and then you sort of focus in on the people of the city. But then you're just sort of like starting over again. It's like, oh, we've told all the tales of the people that we've seen. The end? Question mark. You know what I mean? But oh, sure. It's starting all up again. I don't know. There's something about that just seemed like, well, that was the best you could do, huh?
In contrast, Magnolia, and I'm sorry to keep bringing it up, but it's my closest. Magnolia. There's a lot of weird similarities where it's just here's a movie about life and people and all. So Magnolia doesn't. It's a movie about everybody and all their problems, but it doesn't show you. Look, here's everyone. Like that movie in, and this isn't a spoiler. It ends on one story,
right?
And one look from one person. Like it makes it about the story you've been watching. I don't need like, did you know that this movie's a microcosm for life? Like, of course it is. Like,
well, they both had their plague of frogs moment with the snow
The joke is like Magnolia can be incredibly heavy handed in a very outrageous way. But that, I think I like that movie so outlandish and crazy by it's act three or whatever, right, that I do kind of like that. But anyway,
well, I have to admit,
this isn't the Magnolia podcast.
Well, so when I did see Magnolia, I think this relates. When I saw Magnolia and I saw the plague of frogs, that was the moment of the movie I was like, I might be out now. I'm not sure.
Interesting.
But I
for
might
me,
be
it,
out.
It was the moment where I was like, I'm all in. Like, I was just like, fuck yeah. Like,
but
let's go.
I'll say now, having seen the snow moment, I'm kind of like, I'm not in enough. You need to pull me in more. You need more frogs, son.
Well, that's like, yeah, it's like if you're going to do it, you either do it subtly or like incredibly not subtly with
right.
a rain of frogs. Like, that's just crazy. A bit like, hey, I will say this. Did you expect that to happen in that movie?
In that movie? Well, unfortunately, I was expecting something. I didn't know it was a plague of frogs, but I was expecting something to happen because people had been dumb shits and had said, you won't believe what happens in the...
I'm not going to spoil it for you. All I got to say is ribbit, ribbit, look to the sky or whatever. Yeah, kind of. No,
so.
I know. I had the benefit of knowing... I hadn't seen a frame of the movie when I saw the movie.
Right.
And didn't know anything about what was going to happen. So, yeah. So anyway.
Anyway, yes, but
aside from human error, there is... it's certainly unexpected.
Yeah. So Magnolia 2 Crash.
Crasholia.
Crasholia. Are we missing any stories? I keep trying to rack my brain and think of any stories.
No, those are the main ones. I mean, I think there's a wrinkle. That's the other thing. Matt Dillon has yet another wrinkle to him besides what we talked about, which is like his father is suffering from, he needs some kind of surgery, has like kidney stones or something. I don't know. Like,
right.
Is having trouble.
Painful.
And he tells, there's this sort of side story where he visits an insurance woman and is explaining his dad needs surgery, but he's being super racist while he's doing it. And then they try to put in there this like American History X side story of like, my dad was the Oscar Schindler for black people and like was the janitor that helped all these people of color like come up and helped them, and then they gave away all his job contracts for affirmative action and he lost everything and lost his wife and all. And so I think they tried to paint like a here's why Matt Dillon is racist backstory,
right,
to sort of not justify his racism but sort of like explain it as a character. And I couldn't help but in the back of my mind, I was like, yeah, but he's an LAPD officer, and that's kind of the culture. I don't really need to know how we got here.
Right.
Like, he's a cop.
Well, sort
like,
of the, I mean,
buy it.
Even by the movie's own rules. I mean, at one point, after Ryan Felipe has said, I'm not, you know, riding with you anymore, Matt Dillon, and he's saying goodbye, Matt Dillon says to him, look, just put in a few more years, you'll understand where I'm coming from, basically. So
a few more hours.
Yeah, right, exactly. But that's, I mean, what he's basically saying is that he doesn't need his dad's whole backstory. What he and the movie are saying is like, the racism is intrinsic to the job. It comes with the job eventually, which is like, that's a bold enough statement. Well, then if it comes to the job eventually, then why do you need the backstory of like, well, I'm not racist or my dad wasn't racist. Maybe I am and always have been. But yeah, I mean, it almost undermines what the movie is maybe saying, which is like, well, maybe the institution itself is the problem.
Right.
And that's part of it, too. It's like, I understand complication, but it's also like, well, if you're going to introduce this idea, why not try and, you know, explore right. that idea? Why yeah. just keep throwing all these things out without any sort of connection?
Well, it's almost like what we're saying is the movie has some really great ideas and it explores some really great topics, but in its attempts to like have it all, to have its cake and eat it too, and tick every box, it's almost a disservice to what's working in it,
right?
Because it just sort of gets buried in everything.
Yeah, so much. Yeah, I mean, it's the sheer weight of everything. And I will say too, and it's maybe, I don't know how to, you know, if this would change anything, but there is this like sheer piling on of tragedy, like
right.
you almost, and I don't know where the line is in this movie, because this really is a movie where it's like, well, everything has to be sort of tragic in its way. But there was no light at the end of the tunnel, except in maybe Michael Pena's story, there's a little bit of light. But like in most of these stories, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. There's no, I mean, there's a little bit, I guess, when like, oh, Sandra Bullock hugs the maid. But this is all intrinsic to the stories and the arcs. There's just no natural happiness. You know what I mean? There's no just like, oh, my, you know, my daughter got an A in school today. There's no like, nothing random happens good. All the bad things that happen are, all the random things that happen are bad. You
well,
know?
I guess blank bullets is a pretty good random, you know.
I suppose. But that's not really random.
Tragedy preventing thing.
But yeah, that wasn't really random. That was something, that was a decision made very early in the movie by one right. of the cast. So.
Right. Well, it just paid off in a way that wasn't anticipated
right.
when that decision was made. But
you did see what I was, I mean, actually this is interesting. I will say this to me, when I remember the movie, I remembered it being very obvious in the beginning that like, oh, she just bought a box of blanks. And I remember.
Oh, I don't think it plays that way at all.
Well, that's the thing, is watching it now is like, oh, that's interesting. What seems so obvious to me the first time watching it, I see now is just me just extrapolating, you know, probably as somebody who works in Hollywood. It's like, because somebody took the time to say the line, you know what those are, right? And they right. tried to throw it away as much as possible, but they have to put it in there because that's right. the only foreshadowing.
Well, you could also read it, because he just listed every type of bullet. There is a way where he could be saying it's like the most powerful, deadliest bullets he's got or something. Like right. they're exploding tip bullets or something.
They explode and put yeah. poison in your body.
He's ambiguous enough where he's like, you know what's in that, right? Like almost like it's dangerous.
Right.
That's how it could. I think that's how it's meant to play. And then sure. you realize later. Like, oh,
but it was bullets. Funny to me to realize, oh, that was even more subtle than I thought, and no wonder right. some people pick up on it and some don't, because it's like, oh, I see that that's actually a little bit more nebulous than it seems. But I do feel like once you pick it up, you can't sort of put it down again. Like
yes.
if you've noticed that earlier, you're like, you're waiting for the blank to go off. It's Chekhov's blank.
Right. Right. I do appreciate that the film did provide us with some sort of answer, because if it had left it as just miraculous, you know, magic,
right,
that would have been bad.
Yes. For sure.
So thankfully it didn't. But it's interesting that the characters think it's miraculous, even though we as an audience member understand that it's not.
Right.
That's kind of interesting.
All right. I think I'm done then.
Yes. So, Mr. Nelson, we have arrived at the hour of truth.
Oh, man.
Did Crash hold up?
See, this is interesting, because does it hold up to Oscar scrutiny? No. Not at all.
No. Clearly no. But I think we both kind of knew that.
Right. And I don't think we were either of us expecting it to. Does it hold up to sort of what I saw the first time? Is it as good as the movie I saw the first time? I would say yes. And I think there's actually, you know, having, you know, 15 years of experience and, you know, a little time to think on this movie, I guess, in the back of my head, I would actually say there's things about this movie that I admire more this second time. So I guess by the definition of like, did I like it as much or more than the first time I saw it? Yeah, it holds up. If you're looking for me to say this is a great movie across the board, I can't go that far. But I actually would say, compared to my first time, it holds up, because the first, like I said, the first time I saw it, I liked it. It was good. There was good things about it. Very right. impressive performances. So yeah, I can actually say it holds up. This is not like the strongest holdup I feel like I've ever done, but I actually can kind of.
Sure.
It's not nearly as bad as I was afraid it was going to be.
Yes.
Based
yes.
on everybody's reactions over the years.
I actually agree with you. And even though we were a little critical about the movie, and it certainly is not a flawless film, it has a fair amount of flaws. I actually thought it held up as well, mainly because it's like I said, the history for me is people saying it's shit.
Right.
Let me be clear. Like, it's not a shitty movie. Like,
no.
It's not. There's nothing about it that's like, oh, what garbage. Like, it's actually a really interesting, layered, dense, complicated movie, which usually I like. The problem is it swings for the fences and, you know, you don't always hit a home run.
Right. So it's you swing and you hit a double.
Yeah.
And that double gets you Oscar gold.
It's like a goofy double with like an error in the field where, you know, they maybe caught up and dropped the ball and then they run around and get an extra base you didn't think they would. Like, it's not a home run. It's like it's a double or a triple maybe. But like, I think there's enough there. And, you know, we've actually talked about this movie in the aftermath far longer than we do most of the films we watch. So I actually, even just our digesting it, talking about it, like, there's something to that movie.
Well, I think there's something.
It's not a perfect movie, but there's something to it.
I mean, it's most telling to me that we were watching this movie, and I think both of us were expecting to be like, at some point in the movie, just have that reaction.
We were not like chuckling by
just like laughing our asses off at some point because it's like, well, this is just too much. I feel like we felt those moments, but it wasn't like rip roaring hilarious. It was just sort of like, oh yeah, that's too much, that's too bad. It was almost like disappointment because it's like, oh, that should have been better. Oh, okay. But I feel like the real thing about this movie that I just can't kind of get past is you could take, say, any like 2 minutes out of this movie, out of context, just watch it not knowing what you're watching, and I feel like you would be like drawn in and you'd be like, I don't know what I'm watching, but this is very interesting. These characters are very, very distinct. The acting's great. The look is great. I mean, it's obviously a well-done movie, I feel like. If you take it piecemeal, again, add it up, I don't think so, but
I think you're right. Yeah. And that speaks to what we talked about, where it's like, this is working and it's good. There's just like too much of it.
Right.
And I think you peel back some of those onion layers and simplify the movie a little bit and just stick to the really stronger stuff. And I think it'd be quite a good movie.
I think there's one more thing we need to address, which is we've been sort of talking about this movie in a vacuum, which is like, well, it won the, you know, Academy Award, but and maybe it shouldn't have. But we really haven't discussed what it was up against. So here's what it was
what
up against.
What did Crash defeat and beat for Best Picture?
Here's what Crash defeated. Good Night and Good Luck. Already a movie I remember liking better.
It's a great movie.
Capote.
Good movie.
Munich. I have a story about Munich. I'll have to get back to you on that one. And here's the one that really kind of makes me scratch my head, but I guess I can see what happened there. Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, yeah, that should have won.
Brokeback Mountain, which I think nowadays people would look back and say, oh, yeah, that was obviously a great movie.
Well, Ang Lee got Best Director. I remember that. So it got some accolades.
Right, and
But, yeah. that should have won Best Picture.
Looking at this, though, the Oscars were all over the place. Crash got Best Picture. Brokeback Mountain, Best Director. Best Actor went to Capote for Philip Seymour Hoffman. Best Actress was Reese Witherspoon for Walk the Line. Supporting Actor, George Clooney and Syriana. Oh, I love Syriana. Best Supporting Actress, Rachel Weisz in The Constant Gardener, a movie I forgot existed.
Well, here's my top question.
Uh-huh.
Because this is what I've discovered is a secret truth. What films won the writing awards? Because those are always the actually good movies.
Okay. Well, the best adapted screenplay was Brokeback Mountain. I will give you the
checks
names of what was up for original screenplay.
What was original?
Crash was up for original. Good Night and Good Luck. Match Point, the Woody Allen film.
Yep.
The Squid and the Whale by Noah Baumbach. And Syriana by Stephen Gagan.
I'm going to guess Good Night and Good Luck won.
You would be wrong. Crash won.
Well, there goes my theory.
Yeah, the thing is, I think I would actually have nominated most of the others above that one. Maybe not Match Point. But
Well, it's not obviously not the way every time, but generally I find that the writing awards give like, they usually, it's the cool good movie.
Right.
It's like Get Out.
Yes.
Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, like all the movies that should win but don't.
Yeah.
Usually get those awards.
This is the you got an Oscar. Go home. Don't complain. Don't tell your friends you shoulda.
Right.
Just take it and slink out the back.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nelson, for watching 2004's Crash. But I must ask the question, what are we doing for February next month?
Well, we are going to go a completely different route. We are going to watch 1996's Crash.
Fuck it, baby.
We weren't gonna,
you were
but
getting
we
getting away from the leg fucking. It's not happening.
Not happening. We were so disappointed we didn't get the Cronenberg one. We're gonna force you all to listen to it. We are scuttling our original plans for February. Valentine's Day is gonna be Crash 96. You're getting the leg fucking, people. Yes. There's no way around this.
We can confess that while we both love the idea of flipping a coin, we both definitely wanted the other movie to win. So fuck it.
We're gonna doing
watch it.
We
God
went,
damn it.
Went to too much trouble.
We're watching the fucking Cronenberg Crash. It is happening.
It's so happening next month.
February when we watch the other Crash movie. 1996's David Cronenberg's Crash, coming to you soon.
That's right.
In the meantime, if you would like to send us an email, keep in mind we still have the email contest going. The sixth unique person we get an email from when we started the contest, will receive a mystery prize. One slot is down, so we have five more to go. So send us an email at holduppodcast@gmail.com for your chance to win the mystery prize.
I also want to interject here. Not only are you getting Crash in February, you may get a special extra that we're cooking up in the lab. Me and Longino. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but be looking for maybe a little something special before Valentine's.
Yes, keep your ears out for what's coming. You can also visit us at our website, holduppodcast.com. There you can find links to our Twitter page, our Facebook page, and our Instagram accounts. And until next time,
nobody move, nobody gets shot with a blank.